by pressing down a special key and place a little melody. By pressing down a special key and place a little melody.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We always welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and we have a website for the program, which you can find at radioinvivo.net. All of our past programs are there on the website. And there's approaching 60 hours of programming available on the wide variety of topics we've featured here on the show, so please do check that out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you will get right to the podcast site. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, this week it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Ólafur Pálsson. Ólafur is a native of Iceland, and he is a clinical psychologist and associate professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at UNC Chapel Hill. Prior to coming to UNC, he was on the faculty of the Eastern Virginia Medical School and served as director of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at that school from 1996 to 2000. Ólafur has conducted numerous research studies on the mind-body connection over the past 16 years, including studies on hypnosis, biofeedback, psychosocial health influences, autonomic nervous system functioning and brain activity, hormones, and the immune system. He has also collaborated with scientists at NASA on developing novel technologies to improve health and mental performance. And we are going to go into all of that over the course of the hour. Ólafur, thank you for coming in today and joining us on Radio In Vivo.
Well, thank you, Ernie. It's a pleasure to be here.
I would like to start our conversation with the work that first brought you to my attention. And when I read about it, I knew immediately I just had to get you to come in and be on the show. One of your specialties as a member of the Department of Gastroenterology and Hepatology is the use of hypnosis to treat irritable bowel syndrome. I'm just fascinated to hear considerably more about that. So why don't you start us out by describing IBS for us? I know it's a very common disorder, is it not?
Yes. IBS is or irritable bowel syndrome, is one of the most common problems of the functional GI disorders range. Functional GI disorders are a number of disorders, but this is the most common one. And what it means, what a functional GI disorder means, that is that there is something wrong with the functioning of the gut without any kind of structural damage that you can observe. So the gut acts up, behaves abnormally without any damage or ulcers or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And this particular disorder is the most common one, and is characterized by abdominal pain that is recurrent and can be quite severe, and also disturbed functioning of the gut, either constipation or diarrhea or a mix of the two. And like you said, it is a common disorder affecting about 10-15% of the general population, more common in women for unknown reasons. And a lot of people have a hard time with it, and it's quite hard to treat. About half of people get significant benefits from general medical management, but a significant proportion of patients do not do well with standard medical care, and that's when other methods like hypnosis come in.
I see. And the etiology of the disease is really unknown, is it not?
Yes, it is largely unknown. What is known is that it is quite complex. Mm-hmm. There seem to be psychological factors involved. There seems to be something odd about the way the brain regulates the functioning of the gut. And there are other things like hyperreactivity in the gastrointestinal tract to stimuli. So things that would usually not upset the gut in normal people do upset people with IBS because they are more sensitive. They have lower thresholds to pain and stronger muscle reactions to things like food and stress.
I see. Well, tell us about the standardized protocol that you have developed for the use of hypnosis to treat irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes, because psychological factors are clearly one of the contributing factors in IBS. People have tried for a long time to use psychological methods to help people get relief from IBS. And back in 1984, it was discovered that hypnosis can have quite an impact on this disorder. And the first study was done in England at that time, and several other studies followed. But the problem is that this is a highly specialized method of using hypnosis that is unusual, and most people really wouldn't know how to apply hypnosis to something like a gastrointestinal problem.
Sure.
And because of that, we decided to standardize the treatment so that everybody who is experienced in using hypnosis clinically could apply this treatment. So we wrote a 7-session hypnosis protocol and tested it, and we have now tested it in 3 studies and found it to be effective for the majority of patients. They achieve lasting reduction in abdominal pain and other symptoms from this. And the what is unusual about this treatment is that it is word for word the same for every person. So, like I like to say, if you can read, you can treat. although you have to know hypnosis. It is not like something that you can just read like a story.
Sure.
Because
so it's carefully scripted out.
Yes, absolutely. And but it is benign. It does not have any negative side effects. People react very well to it. It doesn't work for everybody. But we found in our first 2 studies that over 80% of patients achieved significant improvement. And that's especially notable because all of those patients were patients who had failed to get relief from standard medical care already. Right. So this is quite promising. And because we have the scripted protocol, that is completely standardized, and anybody can take who is qualified in hypnosis can take and apply. It is now possible to distribute this all over the country, and actually it is now used in several other countries as well. It has been translated into several languages. So there are now more than 300 clinicians in the U.S. in basically every state using this standardized protocol with good success.
Excellent. Well, I understand the protocol, as you mentioned, involves 7 sessions. What type of progression is involved with the program? Are the sessions all the same, or is there, in fact, a progression involved?
Well, hypnosis is a method that uses kind of a sequence of events. So there is an induction, deepening, and then you have some kind of active ingredient, suggestions and imagery that you want to have a therapeutic effect, and then you wake people back up from this state and get them back into the normal state. So in that sense, every session is the same, but the imagery we use in each session is different, and the verbal suggestions tend to be a little bit different each session, and we try to build it from one session to the next. So it is a sequence of 7 different sessions, and in between, people also use a shorter daily session at home that they listen to an audio tape, and it's essentially a self-hypnosis exercise. Mm-hmm. And actually, people can learn to do this without the tape and use self-hypnosis as well. Some patients find that quite useful. For example, if they suddenly get onset of symptoms in an uncomfortable social situation or something like that, they can apply those techniques to quiet down the gut.
I see. Well, what is it about IBS that lends itself to successful treatment with hypnosis, such as you've described? Does that imply somehow that the disorder itself is psychosomatic?
Yeah, I think that psychosomatic is probably a good description, in that it both has a psychological and a somatic or a physical component to it. Mm-hmm. It would be wrong to say that psychological factors or emotions cause the problem.
Sure.
But the emotional state affects the disorder quite a bit. It gets worse in many patients when they're under stress. And there seems to be something abnormal or something wrong with the way the brain regulates the gut that contributes to this problem, to this hyperreactivity of the gut that causes the symptoms. And what we think is going on when we apply the treatment is that we are helping the brain to learn to correct that abnormal control of the gut.
I see. Well, how did you get interested in this? This seems like a kind of odd area of specialization. I know that you have your background in behavioral medicine. What led you to this particular area of specialization?
Well, when I graduated in clinical psychology, I wanted more training in behavioral medicine, which is basically the field of applying psychological methods to improve health or maintain health or address health problems. And I found a postdoctoral fellowship with Dr. William Whitehead here at UNC Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. He is one of the world's experts on irritable bowel syndrome. So it was kind of a matter of convenience that we started working together to apply hypnosis, because I had background training in clinical hypnosis and I had been applying it to other problems. But at that time, it was becoming clear that hypnosis seemed to be unusually effective compared to other psychological methods in treating IBS. So it was actually his suggestion originally that we would create this completely standardized method so that it could become more applicable and also could be tested more scientifically, because we know that we are applying exactly the same treatment to mm-hmm. each patient. So whatever active ingredients there are, we can test in a reliable fashion.
I see.
I have to admit that I did not expect this protocol that I just basically sat down and wrote to be this effective, but it has been a very pleasant a surprise that has gradually reinforced itself over time, anybody who tries this basically seems to be achieving good results with a large proportion of the patients. So what we're doing now is we are trying to get this into the hands of more clinicians nationwide, because there are thousands of people using clinical hypnosis in the U.S., but a lot of them do not know very well how to apply it to GI disorders.
Sure, that must be kind of a foreign concept still at this point, but I'm sure that's coming, thanks in large measure to your protocol.
Yes, we are basically the only place in the U.S. Studying the application of hypnosis for GI disorders right now.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that there had been some controlled studies of the protocol. Could you describe those in a little more detail?
Yes. Well, we conducted initially two small studies to try to understand how the protocol has its effects on the gut. So we measured several things before and after treatment to see what would change in the gastrointestinal tract and in both the psychological and physical functioning of patients. I can just summarize that very quickly, because what we found was that we could not measure any physical changes that we could correlate very well with the improvement. We, for example, measured the pain thresholds of the patients inside the gut by applying balloon inflation pressure on the wall of the gut, because it is well known that patients with IBS are more sensitive to pain than other people. But we did not see that change at all after treatment, which was kind of a disappointment, because we thought that is how it would help.
Sure.
And we measured several other physical things like autonomic nervous system functioning and other effects, but we have not been able to pinpoint how the treatment works. And what I suspect is happening is that it is more on a brain level. So it may be somewhat futile to try to look for the changes that we are achieving in the gut, because it is probably the pain control and control of the regulatory mechanism of bowel functioning that happens at brain level that is changing.
I see. So the positive results you've been getting and the 80% success rate, that's largely subjective measures from the patients themselves.
That's clinical symptoms.
And if they feel better, they are better.
Absolutely. And these are not transient changes. These are changes that last for years.
I was going to ask you about that. Do patients who've been successful with this, do they need to come back at some point and kind of get a booster shot, as it were?
Typically, they do not, and that is one of the most encouraging things about this type of treatment, is that it is a 3-month course of treatment. The way we use it, at least, 7 sessions, 1 session every other week for 3 months, and in between those visits to a clinician, the patients use this audio recording at home. But mm-hmm. after that, after they're done, they don't have to do anything more. They don't have to apply this at all. It seems that something has been readjusted on a cognitive level, on a cortical level, that allows this therapeutic change to last for months and years. So like I mentioned before, in our studies, we found over 80% of the patients to be significantly improved after treatment, and we only followed them up to a year or actually only 10 months after treatment. Mm-hmm. But another team in England has now followed their sequence of 250 patients up to 5 years, and they find that over 80% of the patients, using a slightly different hypnosis method, over 80% of the patients are still improved 5 years later.
Wow, that's remarkable.
Yeah.
With this really amazing success rate, I mean, that's an amazing success rate for any treatment, particularly of a chronic and, you know, debilitating condition like this. And these, as you described, are most often patients who have failed standard medical management.
That's correct.
You went into a little bit. I'd like to hear a little bit more. What are your ideas about how this works physiologically? I mean, of course, we know that the gut and the brain are strongly tied together. But what do you think is going on here that makes IBS hypnotherapy so effective?
Well, as a scientist, I should say that it's unknown. We do not know that. But I suspect that there are at least a couple of things going on. One of them is that the brain regulates input from the gut and processing of that input. And one of the things that happens feelings coming from the gut is that the brain actually is supposed to dampen the input quite a bit. That is to down-regulate the sensory input from the gut. And there are suggestions that is not happening correctly in IBS, so that the brain is not doing its job of basically closing the door to sensory input from the gut. And that might be strengthened with hypnosis. So we may actually be encouraging the brain to do a better job of that.
I see. So In bringing pain threshold back to normal levels, things like that.
Yes. A second thing, though, that we emphasize in the hypnotic suggestions that we give to patients while we're doing the treatment is changing attention to the symptoms. So that they pay less attention to what is happening inside the gut, and that you will automatically attend less to uncomfortable sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And because we know that what is happening inside is not really anything abnormal or dangerous, so it is quite safe to suggest to your cognitive system to systematically start attending less to those internal events.
Right.
That seems to really be happening, because one of the curious things that happens as a result of treatment is that people lose other symptoms as well. That is, they start having fewer headaches, they start having fewer muscle pains, and so on. They, when you track this over time, they report that after treatment they are experiencing fewer body symptoms in general. So it seems mm-hmm. that their mental system is learning to pay less attention to these kind of minor symptoms that you either could choose to attend to or not.
Sure.
And that may also help. So changing the attention and focus is certainly one part of what we do. But there is probably a third component to it, which is we are almost certainly also helping to regulate the smoothness of the functioning, the muscle functioning of the gut, and there are some suggestions that are used also in the protocol, and also in the other main hypnotic approach that is used in England for these purposes. The Manchester group, that is the other main group using hypnosis for these purposes, is uses the imagery of a river, a smooth flowing river that just flows at the same regular rate comfortably, no matter what goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And they use that to kind of help regulate the functioning of the gut and make it less reactive to immediate events. And we suggest that also in our protocol in various ways. So kind of smoothing out the muscle functioning of the bowels is probably a third component. But as I said in the beginning, it is unknown at this point, and we would like to do some further research to understand exactly what the mechanism is. But in the meantime, we are having such good results that there is certainly every reason to use it clinically.
Absolutely. As with so many treatments, you don't necessarily need to know exactly how it works, just that it does.
Yes, that's correct. But especially with this type of treatment that has no harmful side effects, there is no real risk of causing any damage to the patient.
That's wonderful. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Olafur Paulsen from UNC, and we are talking about his use of hypnosis to treat irritable bowel syndrome. Wilfred, I wanted to ask, with the type of success you've described, and it really is heartening to hear that. I'm sure that people are getting really great help, and it's changing their lives. And particularly in light of the very limited treatment options available for IBS, I understand that this treatment has not yet gained widespread acceptance in the GI community. You talked about spreading this out to trained psychologists who use hypnosis, but it sounds to me like the GI community has not exactly embraced it or necessarily even become aware of it yet. Is there resistance out there to this idea? Is there skepticism about the use of hypnosis? What's going on with the GI docs?
Well, I do not think that it is so much a problem with the GI doctors anymore. But hypnosis has a hard time with being a credible medical treatment for any type of purpose, because hypnosis has traveled in bad company in the past. It has been used as a stage act, and sure, there are a lot of bad novels and movies showing hypnosis misused, and certainly it can be misused, but it can also be a very effective clinical tool. But because of the misconceptions that people have about hypnosis, there is a lot of a lack of good knowledge about how this works and why this would be credible to treat a physical problem. It seems to people that the mind or the brain is so far away from the bowels that this is not a very face valid treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But additionally, people are skeptical and nervous about hypnosis. I often have to give patients a lot of education about the nature of hypnosis and why we would use a strange treatment like that before I actually do something with them. The same applies to GI doctors. They don't know much about hypnosis. It's not a very widely known medical treatment anymore. Now it is mostly used for psychological problems, much more than physical problems. Mm-hmm. But that is actually not the way it was a long time ago. In the 19th century, it was used widely for surgical anesthesia, for example. And that's a history that is now long forgotten, when chemical anesthesia became so effective and so easy to use. Hypnosis was no longer needed for that, but it used to be a widely used medical tool for a little while. So it can have medical applications that are quite reliable, hopefully hypnosis is gradually becoming something that people understand is a clinical tool and not something for amusement or something to gain control over people with.
I see. Well, given the close connection, and we've alluded to it a bit, between the brain and the gut, why do you think there is this, perhaps not resistance, but just ignorance on the part of the medical community in general? Every one of us has certainly experienced this firsthand, time and again. You see something disgusting, you feel nauseated, you get extremely nervous and anxious, and you vomit or get diarrhea. I mean, this happens all the time. It's not some new age spiritual type of thing. This is everyday
yes.
life.
Yeah, that's correct, and I think that's easy for people to grasp that psychological influences do affect the gut quite a bit. But I think, as far as the medical community is concerned, the problem lies partly in the way the medical science understands the purpose of what they're doing and the nature of the problems. Mm-hmm. The mind-body gap is very much alive in medical conceptualization of disorders.
Sure.
And that's perfectly fine for some problems, but when you have a multifactorial complex disorders like this one, there is a lot of interaction between the brain or the mind and the gut, and that's at odds with the regular medical conceptualization of physical problems. So
mechanistic.
Yes, it is mechanistic and kind of reductionistic in that they tend to see problems as either physical or psychological. Mm-hmm. And for example, with irritable bowel syndrome, since there is no structural damage, there is nothing that can be readily fixed or cut out or anything like that.
Sure.
Then there is often the misunderstanding that it must be psychological, but that's not really true in this disorder, because there are various gradations of to what degree this is psychological and to what degree physical. For example, not everybody shows any kind of stress, unusual stress or anything like that, but they can still have irritable bowel syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the interaction between brain and gut that seems to be unusual or there are some kind of problems with it, and that is hard for a lot of physicians to grasp, I'm afraid.
Sure.
that it is the interaction between the psychological mind and body that is probably a big part of the problem.
Absolutely. Well, you know, as you've mentioned, this would certainly seem to be a prime example of the mind-body connection at work. And, you know, hypnosis, you know, certainly has become relatively mainstream over the years. Has there been any effort to document exactly what's going on physiologically with hypnotherapy? Has anyone been doing any brain imaging studies of people in hypnotic states, for example?
Yes, there has been a lot of effort to understand what is going on in the brain under hypnosis. Most of that work has been EEG work, that is measuring brainwave activity and how the brain activity as reflected in electrical activity of the brain changes under hypnosis. But there is very little that can be pinpointed that is unique to the hypnotic state. And that is partly because hypnosis is not that unusual of a state. The hypnotic state is a special mental state, but it is something that we experience pretty regularly. And it is not that different from meditative states or being engaged in something that captures your attention and makes your imagination become very vivid and focused. So mm-hmm. to find anything,
so it's a highly focused attention.
That's correct, and that is something that many people don't realize, is that hypnosis is a very active, very focused state. It is not a relaxed state or a sleep state, but a state where the brain is very highly focused on one particular thing, and the imagination is activated. I often liken it to turning out the lights in a room and turning on a flashlight, and whatever you are focusing that flashlight on becomes more intense and has more of an effect on you, but everything else kind of disappears.
Mm-hmm,
And that is what the experience of hypnosis is kind of like. And you can direct that attention then, and whatever you put in that spotlight comes into sharper focus, and that's why you can affect your emotions more, you can affect your physiological functions more, you react more to whatever is put in that spotlight. And the clinician who uses hypnosis is basically an expert at putting the right content in that.
I see.
In that spotlight.
Is that the type of training that you get to become qualified?
Yes, that's correct. you know, one of the problems and also one of the nice things about hypnosis is that it is extremely easy to induce hypnosis. Everybody can learn in half an hour to reliably induce hypnosis. But that's not what clinical hypnosis is about. It is what you say to people after they have after they are in that state that matters. So we use therapeutic suggestions, which are suggestions for the mind to think about and act upon that will have therapeutic effects, and imagery that has the same effect, and that is the clinical part of hypnosis. You don't treat people just by putting them in a hypnotic state.
Right.
That's
the hypnotic suggestion.
That's correct.
That's where the action is.
That's the therapeutic ingredient.
So you don't get anyone, you know, suggesting that they pretend they're chickens or anything like that.
No, not unless we are very bored. No, we don't do that. The clinical hypnosis is very boring to observe because you don't, nothing, it all happens inside the person's head. Mm-hmm. And it is what you do with your imagination and your concentration that really has the effect. And like I mentioned earlier, it is something that people can learn to do themselves. So it is not even dependent on a therapist. It's a mental capability that most people have. There are some people that are not very hypnotizable, and
I was going to ask you about that. Is it true that you know, some people are more hypnotizable than others?
Absolutely.
And some people are resistant altogether.
It's kind of like a normal curve. What has been found in standardized tests on hypnosis is that most people are kind of average. They have a significant amount of this ability to enter this special highly hyper-focused state, but a small proportion of people are nearly unhypnotizable. They just don't have this mental ability. That doesn't mean that they're mentally disabled in any way. It just means that they use their mind in a different way. But also,
is there some kind of genetic phenotype at work, perhaps?
There is no particular trait, measurable, stable trait that is that closely associated with hypnotizability. So it doesn't seem to be very directly genetic. But what I was going to mention was that there is also a small subset of people who are extremely highly hypnotizable. So on the other extreme, and that can be quite useful. For example, you could perform major surgery with just hypnosis as anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
That is done occasionally, although usually you don't need that anymore. You don't need that type of extreme hypnotic ability for most things. So the people that we work with are just people with average hypnotic ability. And most people actually experience hypnotic states again and again. They just don't know that they do that.
Sure.
You know, one of the most commonly experienced phenomenon is road hypnosis, for example. That's kind of a type of hypnosis. When you're driving, you know, home at night, and there is very little traffic, and you are just looking at the road, and just looking at the line in the middle of the road, and you know, your mind becomes involved in something that captures your imagination. You kind of space out. You're still driving, and everything is fine, mm-hmm. but you are in an altered state.
Right. Right.
And that's road hypnosis,
and you can realize that when a deer runs out in front of you, and suddenly you snap out of it.
Suddenly you realize that you were not there. Just like in regular clinical hypnosis, you're still with it. You're still doing what you need to be doing, but you're in an altered state.
Indeed. So clinically, when you're using these methods, How do you induce the hypnotic state. I assume that the gold watch is a thing of the past.
Yes, I don't think anybody uses that anymore. And if they do, you should probably run away, because that's a very old-fashioned, stereotypical way of inducing hypnosis.
Sure.
But there are numerous methods, because all you have to do is just to narrow the focus of attention on one thing and then encourage people to let go and allow things to happen by themselves, and then start guiding their attention systematically. So there is no standard way of inducing hypnosis. Anybody who is experienced in hypnosis can use dozens of ways of inducing the hypnotic state. But what we typically do, for example, in our standard test protocol, is to have people stare at one spot on a wall and listen to our voice and start attending to what is happening in the body, and gradually just letting go and allowing things to happen by themselves, because that is a key feature of hypnosis, is to kind of step out of the driver's seat and into the passenger seat and allow things to happen, and just observe what happens and experience things. And then we narrow the focus of attention and we capture people's imagination while they allow us to guide their experience.
I see. Well, that the state you described does sound very much like a meditative state.
Oh, very much. And some types of meditation are so closely related to self-hypnosis that it is hard to separate them. What separates meditation, many forms of meditation from hypnosis, is that you are not as active in guiding the attention. So in hypnosis, you typically verbally guide the content of what is in the spotlight that I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
But in meditation, often you allow yourself to be open to experience whatever comes into that focus.
That's
kind of the difference, how much you guide.
So it's more directed.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And that's really where the clinical benefit comes in.
Yes.
Is that guidance. Right?
Yes, absolutely. So meditation can help health problems also, but this is a much more direct way of reliably creating specific changes.
And it sounds like you're getting right into the deep parts of the brain and rewiring synapses right in there.
Yes, it seems to take a while, and that's kind of interesting, is that it's not enough just to do one hypnosis session for a problem like irritable bowel syndrome. You have to do this again and again until the brain learns a different habit, mm-hmm. learns to control the experiences from the gut and maybe control the activity of the gut differently. So it takes time, and what we often see is that the symptoms just improve gradually. It takes maybe a couple of months before people notice very significant changes. So it's not necessarily quick.
Sure.
There are other things that you can do with hypnosis that are immediate, but this is not one of them. When you're dealing with a chronic health problem like that, it seems that it takes a while to teach the brain to change its pattern.
I see. Ollie, what are some of the other current clinical applications of hypnosis? For example, do you envision the use of hypnosis expanding into any other clinical areas, such as other GI disorders?
Yes, that's one of the exciting things that is happening right now, is that other functional GI disorders are becoming the target of hypnosis as well. The second biggest functional GI disorder, which is functional dyspepsia, which is discomfort and disturbance in the upper GI tract, is now showing itself to be amenable to hypnotic intervention also. And that is very exciting, because that's a very common problem also, that has been very hard to treat, just like IBS. It's kind of like the evil twin of IBS. But even more biologically rooted problems in the GI tract, like inflammatory bowel disease, where there is actual inflammation and ulcers in the gut,
mm-hmm.
may benefit from hypnosis treatment, and there is mostly anecdotal evidence for that right now. But there is a study under the direction of Laurie Kiefer at Northwestern University, just starting out now, testing systematically whether it is possible to prevent flare-ups of ulcers in the bowel in ulcerative colitis, which is a serious health problem with hypnosis, and they are using an adaptation of our standardized protocol for that purpose.
That's fascinating.
But if I may,
sure.
just to answer your broader question about what other things you can do with hypnosis, this is certainly not the only area where hypnosis is useful in medicine. There are several other areas. Dentists use hypnosis, for example, quite a bit, and in oral surgery it can prove quite useful, especially where people need to be alert during a procedure, so you can't use general anesthesia, but you need basically to get help from them during the operation. Mm-hmm. You can use hypnosis for anesthesia, and one of the interesting things is about that type of work is not only does it seem to be effective for local anesthesia in that type of oral surgery, but you can also reduce the blood loss that happens during that. So the bleeding can be reduced just through suggestions of reducing the bleeding. So that's a direct physiological effect.
Yeah.
And that has been measured and quantified, that the amount of blood is significantly reduced.
That's remarkable.
Yes, that is an immediate physiological effect that is measurable. Another area where hypnosis is often used is to aid childbirth, both to reduce the pain, make it unnecessary for to use medication, so the mother can be more involved and more alert, and also just to speed up delivery. It seems that labor can be shortened significantly. There is a large study on hundreds of women done in England showing that you can shorten labor by hours by using hypnosis to aid delivery.
Mm-hmm.
There are other very impressive applications, for example, to help burn victims in the emergency room. Hypnosis can be applied in the emergency room for all kinds of pain problems, and burns are one of the most severe and most difficult things to address in the emergency room, and there hypnosis is proving to be quite useful, both to help people be more comfortable and, amazingly enough, prevent blistering to a significant degree. That is, it seems that by using hypnotic suggestions, it is possible to reduce the amount of physiological response to the burn, and thereby reducing the problems that will subsequently develop as a result of the burn.
And obviously these would be immediate effects of the
treatment.
Yes,
that's correct. Somewhat immediate, but they develop over hours and days afterwards. And the same with cleaning and treating wounds. Cleaning burn wounds is you know a grueling experience. Sometimes it's very hard, on patients and very hard on staff, because it's extremely uncomfortable.
Sure.
And hypnosis can be used to help there also.
So these are all in addition to the applications we've all heard so much about that are more behavioral oriented.
Yes, that's correct. And, essentially, hypnosis is the best method we have in the psychological domain to treat pain. And it's the only one that can have a huge effect on acute pain. That is the immediate pain experience that comes from tissue damage or something like that. There is nothing else that you can do psychologically that can have such an impact. I mean, nothing else that you can do psychologically can produce sound local anesthesia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible to do even major abdominal surgery under hypnosis in some cases. But like I said, it is not necessarily not necessary anymore in most cases. But
sure.
there are cases when it is necessary, and then it is possible to do that. So yes, it is a very powerful medical tool. It's just not a psychological or behavioral treatment.
With all that being said, it sounds to me like hypnosis is being vastly underused in the wider medical community today.
Absolutely. And this is something that bothers people, especially physicians who are prominent in the field of hypnosis a lot, that it's a healing and helping method that is vastly underutilized, and it has long been recognized officially that this could be widely used. In 1958, the American Medical Association recommended that hypnosis be taught in medical schools as a regular medical method. That has never been implemented. There are large national societies that teach health professionals to use hypnosis, but it's much more mental health professionals who are learning that, although there are some physicians and nurses also, and hopefully more and more. And just to mention on what they are, it's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis mm-hmm. and the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. Those are the two national societies that train most health professionals in this. But this is something that people have to go kind of outside the main training of their own profession to do. So it's a specialized and somewhat unusual skill for especially physicians or nurses to learn these days. And hopefully that will change, because hypnosis does have applications to so many different aspects of medical care. But especially when you're dealing with pain, then that is an excellent method to know to ease people's pain in a variety of areas.
Well, it certainly sounds like it needs to be much more widely utilized. I wanted to ask you, Ole, last year I had a couple of your colleagues from UNC on who were acupuncture specialists.
Yes.
And many of the applications you've been describing sound very similar to the kind of applications they were pursuing with good success. Is there some correlation there? Has anyone taken a look at that?
Well, yes. There have actually been controlled studies looking at analgesia induced either with hypnosis or with acupuncture.
That is pain reduction.
Yes, yes. And even though both methods can produce anesthesia or analgesia, that is, reduced or eliminate pain, they seem to work through completely different mechanisms. For example, hypnotic analgesia, reducing or eliminating pain with hypnosis is not naloxone reversible. That means that if you give a medication that neutralizes the effect of endorphin or internal pain-reducing agents, chemicals in the body that circulate and reduce pain, if you give naloxone which neutralizes those agents, that does not have any effect on hypnotic analgesia. So it does not work through chemical means of chemical circulating in the body, but that's different than acupuncture, which does work at least partly through chemical reactions in the body. It seems that hypnosis works only on the brain level. It is not doing anything out in the body. What it is doing is it is changing the interpretation of pain when it enters the brain and is processed in the brain.
I see. Well, that's a fascinating thing to compare the two. Believe it or not, our hour is winding to a close shortly, and I did not want to let the time pass by without changing the subject briefly, and wanted to talk about some of the work you've done in the past with folks at NASA.
Yes.
And the system you developed there involving video games. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of all that?
Yes. This is an entirely different area in terms of not focusing on gastrointestinal disorders at all. But this is work that I've been doing for about 10 years with scientists at NASA, especially Dr. Alan Pope, who is a senior research scientist at NASA Langley Research Center. Mm-hmm. And what we have been working on are basically methods to improve people's health and people's functioning by measuring physiological signals, especially brain signals, and feeding them back in various ways. And this is an old method, biofeedback, but
sure.
We're using new ways of doing that to encourage healthful changes in people's both mental and physical functioning. So the main outcome so far, there are actually several projects that we have been pursuing through the years, but the one that is furthest along and has actually become a product that is now used clinically is a way of blending brain biofeedback into video games. So you just play regular video games, but without knowing it, the games are influencing your brain behavior to strengthen your ability to concentrate. And this came out of focus at NASA on trying to improve the attention abilities of pilots and eventually astronauts,
mm-hmm.
Because when pilots fly for hours and hours, sometimes they lapse into states that are dangerous because they lose their ability to concentrate, and so then something happens in the cockpit and they immediately have to attend to it, and they're not in a mental state to do that.
Sure.
So NASA wanted to find ways to correct that, and mm-hmm. and this was kind of a spin-off of that. We developed, invented a system that is now patented, and I'm a co-inventor with NASA on this to treat attention problems by weaving subtle influence into video games. So you just play PlayStation or Nintendo video games or regular off-the-shelf video games, but the games operate differently depending on how well your brain is doing at showing the right brainwave activity that is associated with good concentration and gradually strengthening that ability over time.
I see. That is just fascinating, and I wish I had left a little bit more time for us to talk about it, but Dr. Olafur Paulsen, we are out of time, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come in and share all of this really interesting and information with our listeners, and wish you the best for getting hypnosis out there and helping people with IBS and so many other conditions.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
We have got some great guests coming up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo, and all you got to do is check the website, radioinvivo.net, for the lineup. So join us again next time, right here on Volunteer Power, WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And we ask, if you enjoy the program, that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our program. And we will see you next time.